Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Tonight I want to welcome Freddie Silva. He's a best-selling author and leading researcher of ancient civilizations, restricted history, sacred sites, and their interaction with consciousness. He's also a leading expert on crop circles. He has published 6 books in 6 languages, and for 2 decades he has been an international keynote speaker, with notable appearances at the International Science and Consciousness Conference, the International Society for the Study of Subtle Energy and Energy Medicine, and the Association for Research and Enlightenment. In addition to appearances on Gaia TV, History Channel, BBC, and numerous radio shows, he's also a documentary filmmaker, art photographer, and leads private tours to sacred sites around the world. Freddie, welcome. How are you doing tonight?
Not too bad. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. I've been looking forward to this because I have to say your work has put together so many pieces of this ancient history puzzle for me. The connections you make to the mythos around the world and their similarities, the descriptions of the gods, they're making so much more sense to me. I'd like to know what got you started on your research.
Curiosity. Get into all kinds of trouble. It was just curiosity. I mean, I was fascinated with ancient things and very old things when I was young. I was drawing pyramids when I was 3, for heaven's sake. So I didn't have a normal childhood. And there was always something about the story that we've been told by academia that didn't quite sit well with me. Not that I didn't distrust them or anything. It's just that something didn't, you know, the truth has a ring to it. And sometimes you go, I don't know. I want to find out for myself if that's true. And you often find that if you start poking into dark rooms, that sometimes the story ends up being very, very different. And that's basically what I ended up doing, just being very curious about a building in the middle of nowhere, who built it, why, you know, why did it build things with enormous stones, and the mathematics that goes into some of these buildings, which is extraordinary. So I just wanted to get inside their heads, under their skin, and find out, you know, what were they doing here? What did they want with this? And what was this legacy that they left? And, you know, 25 years later, I'm still here asking the same questions. And it's one revelation at the time, but it's very exciting.
It is. And when you look at advanced civilizations and our human history, the more you look into it, the further back we can place existence of advanced, really advanced civilizations, and the date of 11,500 and 12,000 years ago has become a very important date now for independent researchers, wouldn't you say?
Very much so. In fact, it's kind of funny. I had a bet that I was going to bring out my new book before Graham Hancock's, and we came out with the same book on the same day, or I should say the book on the same subject on the same day. So there you go. But we're all, you know, we're all punching into the sort of big bag of curiosity called the Younger Dryas. And my take is to go into the old stories of indigenous people and find out what they had to say, because they were much closer to the events than we are. We tend to think of history as coming from an academic Anglo-Saxon point of view. And the more I travel around the world asking indigenous people and their stories, I found that the stories are much, much different to what we've been told. And yes, they do all pretty much line up, that there were other people here living alongside humans 11, 12, 13,000 years ago. They seem to be living separately from humans, not alongside them, but they were they're almost living on islands, I want to say. They had their own little sort of corners of the world. It was only because of climatic change that they felt compelled to interact with people. And oddly enough, archaeologists will begin to say that, yes, there are certain points in history where we suddenly develop civilization. All around the world, 8,500 BC, we suddenly went on this wonderful journey from being hunter-gatherers and cave dwellers into discovering mathematics and astrology and astronomy and agriculture, animal husbandry. So either we're all smoking the same thing at the same time all around the world, or we inherited this from somebody else. And that's what fascinates me, the fact that the more you ask Indigenous people about the story, the more they all say, yes, there was another culture here. These are the people that we called the gods. Even though they bring them down to earth, they said they were pretty much human, but they were human-like. They were just not quite human. They were a bit different to us. And here's where the story gets really weird, because if you look at the academic model that says none of these people ever talked to each other, they never got around, they were very barbaric. Well, if that's the case, then how do all the stories line up and interact with each other? And in many cases, they overlap totally. You can find the story in South America, which fills in the gap in New Zealand, which fills the gap in Egypt. Now, how is that possible if they weren't getting around? So that is what's exciting about this period in time, that we are all adding to this wonderful story called the Younger Dryas.
Something else I find fascinating is the accounts of not only these beings were extremely tall, but they had elongated skulls and red hair. Yeah. And in so many accounts around the world, talk about that. Were these the beings known as the gods?
Pretty much so. What amazed me was that anytime you go anywhere near the Pacific and the islands, which all the people always said that the islands we see today are the tips of the mountains of their original homeland. And this is an accepted fact 400 years ago in Europe, when the stories began to arrive with sailors that were going around the Pacific collecting these stories. And they do describe these people as being about 8.5 to 9 feet tall, reddish hair, and also with long beards, which in places like South America and the Andes, which is actually physically impossible for men to have beards, it's a genetic trait. You won't see any Peruvians with beards. When you hear these stories again and again, you begin to wonder, they have to be true. They can't be making this up. They also had light or white skin. And no, they were not Europeans, by the way. I've heard that argument quite a bit from Maoris who give me a very hard time. Said, you know, the Europeans saying that Europeans got here first. Yeah, but they weren't Europeans. You're just jumping the gun here. And also some of blonde hair and blue eyes as well. And you find that all the way from South America, Central America, all through Polynesia, all the way to China, Indochina, India, all the way from Mesopotamia, all the way up into the Caucasus region. So a big swathe of territory across the land where every culture describes its people exactly in the same way. And each one of them was a master in their own skill. Great architecture, great stonemasons. There was always one woman who was involved in this. And I should point out there was always seven of them. They were basically guided by an eighth leader who kind of held them all together. So people like Viracocha or Kukulcan or Quetzalcoatl, these are all part of the same group of people. But the one woman that was among those groups was always the wisdom keeper. She was always the one that carried what we call the divine bloodline today. So she held the beacon within the other guys. So a lot of women keep saying, well, the women never get to hear about these heroes in history. I said, yeah, but when you do, they always have the highest position in all the groups. So take that for a consolation. So again, we had these groups of sages, advanced people, prophets, seers, always working in groups of seven led by an eighth charismatic leader. And that's a story that also carries around the world.
Now, when you look back at the Sumerian mythos of the Anunnaki, would these be considered the same beings?
Absolutely. And I had no idea that they were connected. The thing about the Anunnaki is that they've gotten such a bad public relations, mostly thanks to Zechariah Sitchin.
Yeah,
and I'm not going to trash him because he's dead. It's not fair to do that to people. But, you know, at the beginning, he was going off on the right angle. And like a lot of people, he suddenly begins to turn the conversation into an opinion dressed as fact. And that's where he kind of went a bit wrong. If we actually read these stories, the older stories about the Anunnaki and their fellow craftsmen, which are called the Watchers, they're part of the same group of people. It turns out they're actually quite benevolent. they were actually helping humanity. They could see the potential for humanity at a time when we were barbarians. And slowly they would drip feed information to humans because they said, we can only watch. We can't intervene in the direct development of human beings, but we can see the potential. So once in a while we'll drop a story about how you can domesticate wheat, and let's see where we go with that. And I began to get very interested in this story because it picks up in India. They call them the Anunnaki, the people of the serpent, and their bloodline kept going until historical era. You pick them up again in Yucatan. It's the same people all the way. You just have to look at the etymology and the overlaps in the story. So if you read the story of the Anunnaki and the Watchers, it turns out that they were trying to build a kind of a human civilization. They're trying to help us out. But what happened was, and we don't know the reasons why, is that as a small group of Watchers defied their orders not to interact directly in human affairs. That's why they're called Watchers. Or as they call them in the Hopi territory, they call them the Lookers. Now, the Hopi describe these people as being absolutely essential in helping them escape the Great Flood 11,000 years ago. Without their help, the Hopi and most of the people around Arizona today would not be where they are. So they give them, you know, huge praise to people that we usually tend to downplay as being very wicked. So something is wrong in this story. So going back to the original transcripts, they were saying that there's a small group of Watchers who defied orders to interact and breed with human women. And that's where the problems occurred, because when the women gave birth, most of them died in childbirth because, being of a different stature and a different DNA, the women gave birth to infants. The Wichita of Oklahoma have the story that some of these enlightened people mated with their women and the women died in childbirth. They still remember this. It's incredible. And so the other Watchers were reined in by the lords of Anu, and they said, listen, we're losing control of these renegade Watchers. They actually called them bastard Watchers, by the way, the bastard Watchers. We need to rein them in because they're teaching the children of the earth things that they shouldn't be at this early stage in their development. Things are not going to end well. So they tried to rein them in. They actually caught a whole bunch of these renegade Watchers. They put them in jail. Some of them, they actually hid them inside volcanoes, chained upside down, so they would never interfere with humans ever again. But the Watchers were losing control. They said, we tried to do our best to rein them in. And now the bigger problem is that the offspring of the offspring of the Watchers who mated with human women, the Nephilim, have run amok. These are the real giants of history, the ones who were barbarians, who basically ate people for sport and taught humans about violence, about making metal armaments so they can kill each other. They were the real problem, the second iteration of their offspring. And at this point, there's a big conclave that takes place with the lords of Anu. And they got the four main Watchers together and they said, listen, the Earth is about to cross a big debris field of asteroids. We're going to manipulate these rocks to hit the Earth. It's going to cause a tremendous flood. We're going to have to wipe things out. There will be survivors. We'll forewarn some humans to take seeds of everything, because when the waters subside, they'll have to rebuild from scratch. We've lost control of these renegade people. And you can feel this sort of really bitter sweetness about the whole story. They knew that they had no choice but to engage in this really barbaric act. But in the end, without it, we wouldn't be the people we are today. There's the irony. We'd actually be a planet run by extremely tall people who are basically cannibals. So we actually should thank the Anu and the Watchers, the ones who didn't defy the orders, for the fact that we're here having this conversation right now. And I wonder how many people have actually read the story, and it's, you know, without prejudice and without reference to Sitchin. Read it for what it is, because that's the information that I ended up with. And it's a much more beautiful story. And these are the people that left us, you know, the wonderful buildings that we call pyramids and ancient temples today. So their legacy is really quite profound.
And it makes more sense. And when I look at the two brothers, Enlil and Enki, it seems that Enki was the more compassionate, I would say. Is that something you would agree with?
Yeah, Enlil had a short fuse. He said, just forget the humans. Look, you know, they'll have to get there on their own time. We did the same thing ourselves. We went for our own issues. And the Anu had their own issues too, by the way. They were very human in that respect. And Enlil was pretty much on had a short fuse. He just wanted to get on with the work and forget the humans. Let's just take care of our own, almost like politics today. But Enki was very much a real lover of humans. He said, look, we've got to give them a chance. You know, they're up against terrible things. I feel responsible that we allow some of the watchers to go down and do stupid things and teach them, you know, information that barbarians really shouldn't have at this stage in their development. And the two make for bad bedfellows. So I feel responsible that we should at least try to, you know, salvage the situation. And that's very much true. There was a certain human aspect to this, and they really did care about us.
Now, something that I didn't know until your research is the connections in New Zealand to the gods of Egypt, and there's a place called the birthplace of the gods.
Yeah,
can you tell us about that?
I would be here for days talking about it. I have been there 6 times now, and I can't get enough of it. And I've actually had people who've the Waitaha, who are the traditional and indigenous people of New Zealand, and possibly one of the earliest settlers there, long before the Maori, thousands of years before the Maori, which brings up some really quite contentious political problems in today's climate, because they claim to be the indigenous people, but they're not. It's in their own history. The Waitaha had this oral tradition, which has recently been published, which I was privy to, and they said that when we were in Easter Island to begin with, we used to be visited by these gods called the Urukeu. They used to come from a big land in the east, and they used to go to somewhere else, and every year they would stay on Easter Island. They would give us a bit of knowledge, which formed part of our knowledge of the universe, and then they would leave. And next year, they would come back. And then one year, they failed to return when the tides of chaos created the great deluge. So this oral tradition is over 12,000 years old. I couldn't believe I was reading this. And they talk about the gods being in the middle of the ocean. They were caught in the middle of the Pacific when the meteorites struck the Earth. So they basically were submerged by massive tidal waves, but still managed to salvage one of their boats to reach New Zealand. Now, 2 generations go by, the flood waters recede, Easter Island is now half the size of what it used to be because the sea level rose. And they talk about that, by the way. They even called the islands of Easter Island. There were several land masses then in that time. And they said that the children, or the grandchildren of the gods, the Urukeu, they basically came back to Easter Island and they began to remap everything because all the lands that they knew had now submerged. Well, one of their trips was to go to New Zealand to a place called the Birthplace of the Gods. And there are 3 major sites there of incredible beauty. They're all natural landscape temples. One of them is called the Sacred Nest, which is kind of hard to get to. It's a full-day hike, but beautiful. But all around are all these monolithic limestone pillars. And I remember walking around there the first time and thinking, you know, some of these pillars look like they're the eroded faces of something that was carved by hand. Now, any geologist will argue with that and say, yes, limestone, under the right conditions, it will erode, and when the light hits it under a certain situation, you could see the faces of people, animals, and so forth. And it's absolutely true. It's called simulacra, and it happens everywhere. But I found the explanation wanting. Something just didn't sit right with me. And I kept looking more at certain of these rocks and going, I'm sitting in somewhere very, very profound here. Well, when I began to get into the research of the oral tradition of the Waitaha, they actually mention carving these stones with rocks. They mark the outlines with charcoal. They would take these large rocks, they would just pound the limestone, and they would make effigies of their gods. And this is where the birthplace of the gods is. It's a massive outdoor academy. They literally encoded some of their knowledge into each stone. Just like stone circles in Europe have exactly the same technology. Each stone is put into place because it symbolizes a certain teaching. They didn't just pick rocks willy-nilly. They chose one to specify a certain teaching. So they did the same thing at the birthplace of the gods. And I really wanted to find out how all this stuff was, because they talked about a calendar stone. Now, you have 10 to 20,000 monoliths lying around, and you're thinking, I'm looking for a calendar stone. I don't even know what I'm looking for. And after a few years, I finally went to a third site, and I was just walking around very quietly, and the only damn bird in the entire valley, a falcon of all things, lands on this rock, and I looked at this. And I'm a geologist by kind of almost by trade. That was my passion when I was growing up. I don't profess to be an expert on archaeology, but I know things when they are eroded by water and things which when they've been carved by hand. And this certainly was human-made and assisted. And it had a massive sundial with a face sticking out of it. It's still quite obvious. And I'm thinking, this is way too good to be true. So I did a few alignments. It aligns exactly to 180 degrees to south, grid south. And I figured, well, that's quite a coincidence. But what else does it align to? So the rest of it was just taking a bearing and finding out what was in the sky, because every single temple on the face of the earth mirrors a constellation or a star. They all commemorate their time of construction, like the Great Pyramids commemorate their time of construction in 10,400 BC, according to, Robert Bovall and Adrian Gilbert. I think it's a wonderful theory. So I figured, okay, let's see what was going on here. Two of the main constellations in that part of the world, the Southern Cross and Orion, yet again, which is what links all of these gods together. And I began to take back the alignments back, further back. We're now back beyond the flood. We're now at a point in 14,000 BC when suddenly, for the first time, the Southern Cross rises above the stone. And I mean exactly, I'm thinking, wow, that's a pretty good connection. But 14,000, maybe I'm stretching it a little bit. Let's try Orion. Well, the first time that Orion finally matches the calendar stone, the belt just crosses the periphery exactly at the same time that they're building the pyramids in Giza and also on the equinox. And at the same time that that's happening, on the other side of the valley of the birthplace of the gods, there's their main goddess stone is looking also at the Southern Cross. So it's too much of a coincidence here for me to be making this up. I feel that I've finally nailed the time when the gods were down in this birthplace just before the flood. They were building their own academy.
That's amazing. And I always wonder how, Egypt is so far from New Zealand, they must have had an efficient way of traveling, right?
They were master seafarers and master astronomers, and this is where the story really began to connect, and you really have to learn etymology. And again, you've got to ask the local people what they know and what things mean. You can't take it from an academic viewpoint. We're so distant from it. So when I was in South America, I was reading the story of Viracocha, and I have an Aymara guide. Aymara is almost an anomaly in itself. They have a language that's almost designed by a computer. In fact, a computer can actually understand the syntax of Aymara. It's a designed language. It didn't just develop organically. And my guide was saying, yes, we basically were here when the gods came over from a sinking land in the middle of the Pacific, and they rebuilt Tiwanaku and all the temple cities around Lake Titicaca. They actually came back to rebuild what had been destroyed during the flood. I thought, wow. So is this Viracocha? And they said, well, yes, it's Viracocha and his seven Haihai Wapanti. And I said, wait a minute. Are we talking about the same leader that has seven people, seven craftspeople, one of whom was a woman? Yes. I said, do you realize that's the same story that they have all the way throughout the Pacific, Central America, and also in Egypt, where they're called the Shining Ones, the followers of Horus? And his jaw just dropped. I said, no, I thought that was an original story. I said, well, it is an original story. But in Egypt, they would have understood what you're saying. And I said, what does Haihai Wapanti mean? What are these group of sages mean? And he says, that means the Shining People. So suddenly, you've got the Shining People, seven Shining People led by an eighth charismatic leader, Viracocha in South America. And in Egypt, you had the Shining Ones, who are seven of them, led by a charismatic leader called Horus. So now you have a complete etymological connection. And they were also very tall, red-headed, elongated skulls. So these people were getting about the Pacific and the Indian Ocean as easily as you and I go shopping for groceries. And that's something that does not, people in Tonga won't bat an eyelid when you talk to them about this. They said, yes, they were able to go from A and B pretty quickly because they had complete mastery of the oceans. And that's why you see a lot of etymology, Egyptian etymology, throughout the Pacific. For example, there's an island in the Solomon Islands called Ra Iatea. It literally means the white-skinned people of Ra. Now, what is that doing in the Solomon Islands? So, right. Yes, the story now begins to really connect, the dots begin to connect quite nicely. And it means that the myths that we all heard about pretty much are eyewitness accounts, because that's what they are. Myth is a theatrical device in which to encode information so it never gets forgotten. So you and I could be talking about the story of a guy who goes to a galaxy to rescue a princess and reunite the people. And you go, well, that's a great story. Next week, you'll forget it. But if you wrap it into a myth called Star Wars, you're going to remember that for 30 years, aren't you? That's what myth is great and good at doing. The story seems implausible. It almost seems like a fairy tale because it's designed to help your imagination remember very important information. This is why people don't like Plato about his story of Atlantis. They say it's a myth. Well, yes, it is. He's making you remember a very important piece of information.
Now, something I love to ask researchers of ancient history, how were these megalithic structures built? Like, we'll take, for example, the Giza Pyramid.
Oh, that was child's play. You should go to Baalbek. there are rocks there that I think only one crane now on Earth can lift, and that was only built recently. I go back again to the stories around the world and see if they overlap. Every time you go anywhere from Britain, Stonehenge in particular, the basis of which is 8,000 BC now, the holes around Stonehenge. If you track that story and that myth and you track it to Egypt and North Africa, Anatolia, if you go to the Middle East, if you go to the Pacific Islands, Easter Island, and you ask them, how do they move those big stones? And they say, duh, they use special instruments, like musical instruments, or they use the sound of their voice, and they floated through the air, and these things were built in the course of a single night. Well, you say that story in Central America and in South America, and they'll say, that's the story that we have too. The stones moved through the air to the use of sound or vocal commands, and they were guided into place as though by magic. So I'm beginning to realize that this is probably how they did it. Now, how do you prove this? Very difficult. Until there was a group of people at Princeton who actually looked at this about 20 years ago. And it's called Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research. Their job was to take that gray line between academia and mysticism, you know, which is the area I absolutely adore. Because they're basic. We argue with each other. You know, they call us pyramidiots. We call them quackademics. But in the end, we're talking about the same thing. And there is that gray area of research where things are proven. And what the team at Princeton managed to do was to look at things that, for example, I've written in some of the books about the stories of levitation with rocks. And I always said, look at the type of rock that they were using, because they would go for 600 miles to get these rocks. Now, that's a lot of trouble unless there's something specific in the rock that you're looking for. And the one thing that links them all together is, apart from magnetite and iron, it's a special type of quartz. It links them all together. Now, they looked at this story and said, well, let's take this quartz and put it in a laboratory and let's throw sound at it. So they got this piece of quartz about this big in a tube, and they get playing with sound and amplitude and getting the two fine-tuned. And there's one moment where they actually hit a certain frequency and the rock actually levitates. If I'm not mistaken, it's still on their website, because I think the team closed down a while ago. I think they just died of old age or the lack of funds. But I do believe the video may still be on their website. I am not making this up. I couldn't believe it when I saw this, because again, it completely supports the stories that we've heard all around the world.
What about the precise cutting of some of these stones and some of the work you see, like in places like Pumapunku?
Yeah, and that's a fascinating story because, frankly, we don't know. There are certain accounts that talk about polymers being used. And I actually quite like the theory that the andesite rocks of Pumapunku may have been molted and rehardened like you're making concrete and then poured into molds. Now, it's a very good theory. There's only one slight problem with it, and that is that each one of those blocks that they have, like the H blocks, which you find all around Pumapunku. In fact, I'm going to be there in a few weeks. They are all ever so slightly different. Now, you can't tell me you're going to make a mold for every single rock. The point of having a mold is to make a cookie cutter thing all the way through. So there is that slight problem in that theory. It's not a big problem, but I think they're going in the right direction. There was a suggestion that they were also using high heat instruments of some sort. We've never found the instruments, except for the statues in Mexico, which are held by these enormous people. They're about, I don't know, 18 feet tall. So they look like soldiers. We don't know who they really are. They're called Atlantides. There's an interesting name. And they hold these sort of weapons by their side. And I was talking to my Maya teacher in Yucatan, who knows a hell of a lot of stuff. And he said, actually, that's some of the technology that survived Atlantis. And they were able to use these, they call them death rays. They lost control of them. They were doing stupid things with them. But they essentially had these kind of tools that looked like guns. They were almost like lasers. And they were able to use those to cut, you know, and use them as tools to cut stone. Eventually, they were used as weapons. And I thought, okay, well, that adds up quite nicely. But there is a third possibility here, and it goes back to what we find in Peru, and specifically in Sacsayhuaman. Now, anyone that's been to Sacsayhuaman, and even Cusco, will see how the stones are beautifully shaped like pillows. They're concave at the corners. Some of them have as many as 16 angles. I mean, why not make things easy for yourself? Keep it to four. No, we'll make 16 angles because we can. Now, a group of Russian scientists looked at the stone. It's limestone, a particularly hard type of limestone. And they said something happened between the time it came from the quarry, 20 miles away, and the time that the stones were erected. The fossils that are usually found in limestone are missing at the actual temple. And the only way you can do that is by subjecting the rock to 1600 degrees Celsius and recalcifying the stone. And I'm thinking, okay, that would require a kind of portable smelter. Maybe, maybe not. We haven't seen the smoking gun, but at least the evidence is present. Now, I was reading a journal by a Jesuit priest who was there about 200 years ago. And they were traveling through the Andes. They went across to an Inca grave. And by the way, the Inca didn't build any of this stuff. Even they didn't know who built this stuff. And the Jesuits began to steal some of the clay pots in the grave. And they dropped one of them by accident. This horrible, pungent green liquid came out. And they were kind of upset because they could have sold the pots for a lot of money at the market. So they walked off. A couple of weeks later, they came back on the trail. They went back to the grave that they had passed and where the liquid had spilled. And they found that where the liquid had touched the rock had become molten. And suddenly I began to realize that perhaps there's some plant molecular acid somewhere in the Amazon, which is not far from there, that they found that was able to be harnessed in such a way that they made the rocks very smooth and they could reharden them, almost like concrete. And that fills in that problem. How do you make the rock soft enough to be like concrete but not have to use a mold? Well, you can use a molecular acid. And I was just with a colleague. I call him a colleague now. He's actually a person that came on one of my tours last week to Egypt. He was from India, and we were talking about this story. And he said, actually, in the Mahabharata, one of the sacred texts of India, we do actually have a mention of a plant, an acetic acid that they used to use for shaping the stones that we see in India. So that's another piece of information that just came out. It's never been translated into English, so I want to follow that story up next to see if we can connect these dots together and finally come up with this story of how really did they cut the stones, because it really is impressive when you see 1,800-ton rocks of Baalbek, which have been shaped like butter. I mean, it really is impressive. And why? Because they could.
Right. Now, do you think that the Giza pyramid was a sort of power plant or source of energy?
I think it was several things. I don't think they built one building to be one thing. I like Christopher Dunn's theory. I think it's a very elegant theory. You can't prove it, unfortunately. You're missing the technology and all the engines, but his theory at least is sound. I mean, you can go in the building and see for yourself, and you think, okay, that's quite believable. And I like that. And I also like the fact that if you look at the type of stone that's used for the Great Pyramid, it's actually used to shield outside frequencies. So there's two types of limestone, and there's a red granite interior. Now, we see that a lot in Europe with the giant's graves of all places. And you can measure the frequency. It shields the outside frequencies, and then it basically uses the middle stone to act as a kind of an accumulator and the interior like a coil. So you're creating an electrical charge in the interior. And I'm thinking, perhaps this is part of the technology that they use. But then again, the same technology was also used for achieving out-of-body states. And that's part of my theory of what I believe one of the big things was that was done in the Great Pyramid. Because when you actually go under the Great Pyramid to the original chamber and you get to the King's Chamber, you begin to realize you just follow the path of the initiate. You go from a rough diamond into a polished stone at the top. And the passageways get bigger and bigger as though you're becoming much more enlightened and reaching a higher state of consciousness. These are all metaphors, but you have to understand the metaphor of the mysteries teachings in order to see the building for what it is. I've been in that box for 20 minutes. I know what happens in there without having to go through any ritual. It's bloody easy to leave the body. It's very hard to get back. It's something I don't suggest people do like it, because people do die in there. And I'm not kidding about this. Leaving the body in the King's Chamber is very easy. If you can't find your way back, they'll find a dead body in the morning. And every other year, someone does not come back into their body. So you've got to be very careful about this place. It's something that was actually done only after 10 years of initiation into the mysteries. It's about control of energy, and specifically control of the energy of the human body. So for me, the building is actually one of the main purposes of the Great Pyramid. Was used as an initiation point. And it lines up very neatly with what the Egyptians were saying about some of the buildings being used to physically get from A to B. And I didn't know what they were talking about until I kept going more into the story of Osiris as a metaphor, because the ancient Egyptians, very much like the South Americans and the Central Americans, they always said, yeah, in the old days, the gods used to be able to travel from here to the belt of Orion. And the one thing that you'll always hear around the world is always the gods and Orion. And in Central America, they call the belt of Orion the half of the universe. It's where everybody goes to, whether they're dead physically or still alive in their physical body, and they travel to this area in the galaxy. And from there, they take all kinds of little portals to go walk about in the other world, in the other dimensions. Every culture talks about this. So I'm beginning to suspect that they could do this physically. And when I asked the Waitahara in New Zealand, they said, yeah, it's true. They actually could take their physical body from Earth to the belt of Orion, and they had techniques. Sometimes they had special buildings in which they did it in. But they, once in a while, they would take a lucky human being with them to show them what their world was like, so that they could come back and tell the barbarians, hey, we can actually make a great place called paradise here on Earth, because I've seen how it could be done somewhere else. And these are the people that became, you know, the famous leaders of all of our old cultures, ordinary people who'd had this incredible experience. So again, the pyramid is many, many things, and I don't think we'll ever get to the bottom of it. But certainly a power plant, yes. A place of initiation, yes. An energy accumulator, absolutely. So we're just still scratching the surface.
Now, you mentioned Orion. Do you think that that is where the gods originated from? And is there any accuracy to Stitchin's, connections with Mars, that there may have been civilizations on Mars and there was a nuclear fallout or something that forced them to come to Earth? What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, that's two different subjects. let's take the Orion one first. It's, again, I'm reading this from the point of view of all the indigenous stories that I've come across, seeing the connection, the thread, and the thread pretty much is, and I have a whole chapter on the book about this, whether you're talking about the Hopi, the Zuni, the Central Americans, the South Americans, the Dogon, who else? Pretty much everybody in the Middle East, the Far East, and throughout the entire Pacific. So this is a pan idea about Orion being the half of the universe. But they seem to be pointing to the fact that it's almost like a way station. They seem to be saying that the gods came from Orion, or they're associated from Orion, but not necessarily so. It's as though, it's like NASA recently discovering that there are magnetic portals. And I say that again, NASA actually said there are magnetic portals that connect the Earth to the sun, and they open and close every 8 minutes. We now have the technology to understand what these people were talking about thousands of years ago, that there were these wormholes, and they were using these wormholes quite easily. And I begin to suspect that this connection with Orion is the fact that it was a kind of a way station where they would travel to, and from there they would go to other places. Because Sirius comes up quite a bit as well in terms of any of the wisdom keepers. The number seven associated with the seven sisters, for example, all of those things come from areas around Orion, but not necessarily Orion. So I'm beginning to suspect Orion, and specifically the belt, is kind of like a pit stop, kind of like when the gods went from South America to Easter Island to New Zealand. Easter Island was the pit stop. That was the same thing that they were using for Orion. And again, I've just gotten to the point where I've strung these pieces together, and there seems to be another story behind it, which I'm not even sure that even wisdom keepers today quite know, because the story is so old. So much of the information has been lost. But certainly there is that energetic connection, which they claim to be a physical point of departure. Now, for Mars, I was lucky enough to work with a woman with my first book, who is also my editor, and she was also involved in figuring out the Mars connection. This is the one that was popularized by Richard Hoagland. He was part of that team, and he kind of went rogue, and there's a lot of bad blood between these people, which I'm not going to get into. Let's say some people became very famous because they took the information, and the other ones were forgotten. So I'll tell you about the people that were forgotten. Myers and Percy, David Myers and David Percy wrote a book called Two Thirds, A History of Our Galaxy. I don't recommend it because it'll fry your brains. I suggest you get it from the library, acclimatize yourself with the story, and then if it's your thing, if it's your bag, then buy it. It's a very big book. You could actually, you know, knock someone's head off with it. And she was telling me about the story, how originally the entire story was kind of almost channeled by David Percy. And Myers, I believe, was the physicist who co-wrote it. And they were saying that at one point there was a big civilization on Mars, and they fell prey to a massive environmental catastrophe. I don't think I remember the word nuclear disaster coming around. I think it was a natural catastrophe. Ironically, kind of like the one that's upon us right now with climate change. And they had to basically find somewhere else to live. Now, we're talking millions of years ago, by the way. And they were saying that they found Earth, which back then was, you know, not quite habitable. It still needed a few things to happen for things to become habitable. But they recreated, and I'm condensing a very big story here, they recreated the whole Cydonia region on Mars on Earth. And I thought, I got to hear about this one. I mean, surely you got some proof for this. And she says, actually, we do have proof. If you take the entire Cydonia region of Mars and the five-sided pyramid and the face and the other structures around it, and again, you got to remember, this guy was channeling the information, and you have someone else doing the mathematics and the geodetic positioning. They found that all of those places on Mars fit the whole southern section of Britain, including Stonehenge, Avebury, and all its satellite temples. So the places that we see today have been built upon original temples, because these are not very old sites. They're 4,500 years old. So they're on top of original structures that were already there a long time ago. And again, the math works. So you can't make this stuff up. It either fits or it doesn't. And when you take the overlay of Cydonia into these places in southern Britain, it fits beautifully. And I found it to be a very compelling theory altogether. So, but again, this took place over thousands, and I want to say about 2 million years that this thing took place. So, yeah, it's a great story. But it's a book I don't recommend, and yet I do for that reason. It may seem very far-fetched, and it has a lot of pictures too, which really helps.
Now, what are your thoughts on Atlantis? Was this a continent? Was it a real place? Or was it just what they called planet Earth? What are your thoughts on that?
It's much more complicated than we thought. It goes back to my theory that the gods lived on seven islands, or places that behave like islands, which are pretty much, you know, pieced out in the entire book. And one of them was about finding out where was Atlantis. And a lot of the indigenous people and the stories that I came across said, well, we'll never find out exactly where it was, except for the middle of the Atlantic Ridge, because that's the obvious one. That's where the name comes from. There was also partly the Sahara, because that was all ocean, all the way up to the pyramid. That was an inland ocean. And when the meteorite struck at the end of the Younger Dryas, the entire area that used to be what was called the Triton Sea emptied in one night into the Atlantic, and that created the Sahara. They were saying that there was also parts of Western Europe. There's also other islands which are now submerged. Essentially, the Earth has changed so much, we really can't get a good grip on it. But certainly the Azores, today's Azores, are essentially the remains of the central nucleus of that island. And if you take a bathymetric map of the entire area around the Azores, it actually still resembles the vaguely triangular shape of what the map makers in the Arabic world were portraying Atlantis to be like. And that was in its last iteration, because Atlantis fell three times, which coincides very neatly with the three driest periods. There was three major ice ages, which occurred within, I'd say, about 3,500 years. So that pretty much details quite neatly that this island was sinking and sinking and sinking, and finally it went down in one go. They recently dredged stuff from, I believe, 6,000 feet depth around the Azores, and they found that at one point, in 13,000 BC, that was a beach above sea level. And they also found freshwater plants there. So the whole thing literally did collapse in one go. Now, here's the connecting part of the story. Plato, who inherited his story from Solon, the Greek scholar to whom was told the story in Egypt. So Plato didn't actually create the story. He was given the story by another Greek historian. The Egyptians told Solon that, you know, in 9,600 BC, the final sinking of Atlantis took place, and that it was a continent that was much, much bigger than we can possibly imagine, way beyond the Pillars of Hercules, which is the Straits of Gibraltar. Now, take that at face value. If you go over to Central America and you ask their story of the inundation, they'll say, oh, yes, there was a big continent called Atl in the middle of the Atlantic, where we get the name Atlantis from, and they arrived in Yucatan within 200 years of the big catastrophe, and they were called the Itz. It literally means priest magician, and they were led by a godman called Itzamna, and he had three partners who landed in three other places along the Yucatan. One was called Quetzalcoatl, the other one was Kukulcan. They were part of the same brotherhood who survived Atlantis in order to rebuild the temple cities in the Yucatan in the mirror image of the land from which they came. And the Chilam Balam, the sacred book of that region, actually lists the date of arrival at 9,600 BC. So you have Plato giving us 9,600 BC in Greece, who was given the story by the Egyptians, and in the other side of the world, they are being told exactly the same date for what essentially was the fall of the Younger Dryas, the close of the Younger Dryas. So that's self-referencing information. And the one thing that links these people together is that their badge of office of these shaman was the people of the serpent. And that was the badge that they also had in Egypt and also in the Middle East. So we're talking about the same group of people coming from the same islands.
Now, another one of my favorite questions is, what happened to them? At some point, the communication was lost. At some point, we don't hear anything else about the gods. So where did they go? What happened to them?
That's exactly the question I asked when I began to write the book. I wanted to know exactly the same information. Yeah, I mean, for thousands of years, we relied on the gods. We talk about the gods, and we honored them, and we eulogized them. And then suddenly, we have a big catastrophe. It wipes everything out. A few people survive. They are met by the gods in groups of seven with an eight charismatic leader. And then after the temple cities are established, they just disappeared, vanished into thin air. What happened to them? Most of them appear to just disappear back into the ocean, back to where they came. They were still picking up bits and pieces from the landmasses that were sinking due to the rising sea levels. But after that, they just, boom, vanished, as if they disappeared to, excuse me, they disappeared to Orion or something. And I was just sort of speculating at this point until I came across a story, and it was in Korea, in South Korea of all places. And they talk about exactly the same thing, that the gods were here for many hundreds of thousands of years. In fact, they lived for incredibly long periods of time. And then they began to slowly drip feed information and knowledge to humans. And sometimes we would get it, and sometimes we'd lose the plot. And the gods would have to basically say, oh, God, we had to start teaching these people from scratch. They're never going to get it. They were very patient with us, by the way. But whenever they gave humans too much information, humans got greedy, and they began to do the things that we are good at, which is stupidity. But also, some of the gods also got a little bit proud, and they also behaved exactly like barbarians. So every once in a while, a big catastrophe comes along and wipes everything, and everything is started from scratch. And the final part of the story in Korea and Cambodia says that this time the gods said, well, we're going to rebuild civilization. We're going to teach humans the arts of civilization. We're going to teach them how to domesticate animals, domesticate crop, know about mathematics and the stars. And then we're going to withdraw the ladder of heaven. And that's where the story ends. And I'm thinking, I got a feeling, knowing of how, for example, the Indian yuga cycles work, that each yuga cycle is determined to teach humans a lesson, or at least we have to teach ourselves a lesson. We go for a certain experience. So every few thousand years, the periods of civilization, we undergo a certain experience. We learn something. Right now, we're in the stage where in the last 4,000 years, the final cycle is to do with ego, the loss of spirituality. And I'm beginning to realize that the reason why the gods disappeared, and we don't know where they went to, by the way, they disappeared because they went to us to figure it out for ourselves. They wanted to figure out that we are the gods we've been waiting for. We have such huge potential that is always put down by religion. You know, you're always told that you're a sinner, that in order to talk to God, you have to communicate through a priest. Well, no, back in any indigenous culture, they'll say you don't need middlemen. You already are an expression of God or the gods, so you can communicate directly using shamanic means or meditation. And I do believe that this is part of the reason why they just vanished. They wanted us to quite figure it out. And in the last 30 years, we've made huge strides in understanding how our subconscious works. And when you do things like transcendental meditation in small groups, you can affect things like the crime rate in American cities, which is a proven fact, by the way, that you can even alter the frequency of water, which Masaru Emoto has done very well in Japan. I begin to realize that these gods disappeared so we can discover the God within us. And that's how we're going to save ourselves from ourselves. So, but as to where they went to, it's still a mystery, and I'm still trying to work it out, and I'm getting no straight answers from anybody. I think they covered their tracks quite well. But if you talk to the Hopi and the Zuni, they say, well, they haven't really quite disappeared. They've just basically gone off world because, you know, if you go into a shamanic moment, they will come in through that connecting point. I mean, in our kivas, when we do ceremony, we do receive through this reed called the Sipapu reed, information from the gods and our ancestors, and we get the information and we share it with the people. That's how they communicate now, very subtle. Sometimes they appear in their flying shields. Usually, you know, about 11:30 at night when we're sitting out there watching the cactus grow, and the flying shield comes along, and those are our friends, and they're very matter of fact about it. I love talking to native people in the United States about this because they're so matter of fact about the flying shields, and they feel honored. It's part of their family. They don't even take photographs because they feel it's kind of crass to take photographs of your friends. You know they exist. That's all the proof that they need. So yeah, they are still around. They get around from A to B using structured craft. I won't use UFOs because these things are identified. We know what they look like.
Now, earlier you had briefly mentioned climate change that we're experiencing now, and you know every however many thousands of years, there are major cataclysms that kind of reset everything. Do you think we're due for one of those, possibly in our lifetime?
Yeah, and I didn't want to end the story in a negative way, but I ended up going there because the one thing that links everybody in the world together again is the fear of comets. Wherever you go around the world, indigenous people are really afraid of comets. Even as far as the Middle Ages in Europe, comets were harbingers of catastrophe. And in fact, the Chinese call them those vile stars. And I'm thinking, what is it about comets that they're so afraid of? I mean, comets come and go. And then something struck me when I was in Peru in November. I got caught in a massive ceremony. I'm thinking, oh, they must be celebrating the feast day of Lammas because the calendars are reversed in the Southern Hemisphere. What we celebrate in May, the Feast of Fertility, is what's celebrated in November in the Southern Hemisphere. But they were saying, no, we're celebrating the Day of the Dead. And I said, but you should be celebrating the Day of the Dead in May. Not now, because your calendars are upside down. Is this a Christian imposition? Oh, no, that we're doing this way before the Christians arrived. And I found the same thing in the South Pacific as well. When they're supposed to be celebrating the Day of the Dead, which is Halloween, which in the Southern Hemisphere should be in May, they're still celebrating it like we do in the Northern Hemisphere in November. And I'm thinking, something here doesn't quite add up. And I'm thinking, what is it about the dead and November where something happened where a lot of people got killed, and the only thing that made any sense was a torrid meteor shower? The torrid meteor shower is that wonderful event every November where for 16 days the Earth crosses a big path of debris. And again, it crosses it again because it's a torrid field. It crosses it again in June. The Tunguska event in Siberia in 1902, I believe, or 1908, that was one of the pieces of rock that came out of the torrid meteor shower. And recently, NASA is becoming much more obsessed with the torrids, as are many astronomers, astrophysicists, and mathematicians. And I am, without ruining the ending of the book, because this is part of the ending, although I have to say there is a happy ending to the story, and I'm not going to ruin it for you. They are beginning to put a timeline where, using mathematical projection and calculation, because they're saying if we look at the major impacts events over the last 11,000 years on Earth, we are now gathering enough information that every once in a while we do get hit with large objects and things are reset. We've had 13 major catastrophes since the Younger Dryas. There was one in Japan in only 2600 BC, by the way, and it's very well recorded. And so they're saying there's a potential that between 2030 and 2042 that the Earth is going to be wiped out by big chunks of this field of debris, which are the remains of a very large comet, like a mini planet that once existed. It's full of mathematics. It's all peer-reviewed. I've written it all down because I can't even remember half of this stuff. It's highly mathematical, but they're saying there's a high probability that we are going through that debris field come 2030. And no week goes by these days without NASA or some agency releasing a press release saying we found more particles up in the sky and they're quite big and they're all coming straight for us. And one of them just missed us the other week and it's the size of a bus. And when I talk to them about this at conference, they say it's ironic how we are beginning to act just like our ancestors used to 11,000 years ago. We are now obsessed with the sky, not just with the stars, but what falls out of the sky, just like our ancestors were obsessed with comets. So I think this is, yeah, the scenario is coming back around. But again, there is a way out of this. There is an antidote, and it's a very positive story. But I'm not going to ruin the last chapter for you.
Well, to end on tonight, I'd like to get your thoughts on why modern day academia refuses to go to, you know, that there were ancient civilizations and, you know, it wasn't just knuckle dragging Neanderthals. Why do they, you know, refuse to accept these, you know, these facts and the research that independent researchers are coming up with?
Yeah, you think that scientists would basically follow the evidence and let the evidence drive the theory, not let the theory drive the evidence, and certainly get rid of any evidence that doesn't fit the theory. That's what's called pseudoscience, which is what they accuse us of. Strange irony, isn't it? You have to understand that academia is very conservative. Archaeology especially, it's only been around for a couple of hundred years. And you have to also remember that the people who funded the early archaeologists were the Catholic Church, who were looking for archaeology to validate the fact that the earth, and I'm not making this up, was created in August the 26th, 4004 BC. So believe it or not, when they first discovered dinosaur bones, they thought that these were fakes. Okay, they were not accepted as real things. And they've been working back from since then. Now, the problem is compounded by the fact that there's few university places. There's not much money to go around. And if you go and publish things which are outside of the accepted range of facts, of comfortable facts, you will not be published ever again and you will lose your funding. And I understand where they're coming from. I really do. I mean, I get trashed by these people all the time. There's one on Amazon who just trashed my book without any basis or on any fact, but that's the way it goes. At least I've got under his skin, which is good. But, you know, revenge is best served cold, and it will be. but, you know, I get where they're coming from, but when I speak to academics on the side and we talk off the record, they'll say, actually, the work that you guys are doing is actually undermining our theory. And I totally agree with what you're doing, but I can't state that because I would lose my job. And I feel for them. I really, really do. They're very honest about it. And the one thing that really sets us apart for the skeptics that are listening is that, you know, the academics, they are who they are because they read a certain amount of books and they get to their theories. Well, we independents read the same books, but we are where we are because we're now not constricted by a dogma. And that's what you get in academic circles. You have to think within this box. You step outside the box, we're going to cut you. And they do. They trash each other like crazy. It's like it's trench warfare in academia. It really is. Now, we are not constrained by university or a mode of thinking or a dogma. I can go over to the geologist and say, what do you think of this? I can ask the archaeologists, what about this? The linguists, the etymologists. And I see the big picture and I go, that connects with that. It connects with that. That's what a lot of these people can't do. They can't think outside of that little box. They won't talk to the geologists. The archaeologists won't talk to the historians. And if these people just communicated with each other, they would see what we can see quite clearly. And it's just because we don't have a degree with a stamp that says, I have a major degree in master's and so-and-so, they won't respect our opinion. That's all it comes down to. It's kind of like a frustrated professional jealousy. But on the side, if you talk to them quietly as friends, they will admit that, you know, the evidence is undermining their precious little theories. So slowly, bit by bit, they'll come round to our way of thinking. And, you know, to leave it on a positive note, there's a friend of mine in England who's one of the world's best psychics. The police are always working with her to, you know, solve murder cases. She has 100% record, by the way, and she keeps a very low profile. Now, she's also an amateur archaeologist, and she's very much into the ancient things. And she actually came up, I want to say about 20 years ago, that the original site for Stonehenge was about 8,000 BC. Well, would you believe that only about 8 years ago, the archaeologists were digging in the holes that were the original site. They found some chippings from the bluestones, and there was some organic material in there that wasn't disturbed. They took some carbon-14 dating, and I'll leave you to guess the date that they came up with. But you're not going to see that date in the visitor center. So the psychic is already way ahead of them. So you see how this works. It's a bit of a cosmic joke going on here, but ultimately the winners are the people who are open-minded and keep, we keep looking at the facts and the evidence, and let's see where that takes us. And that's part of the fun.
Yes, definitely. Well said. And Freddie, I want to thank you so much. That was fascinating information, and I'll have to have you back on again.
Well, twist my arm. Buy me a beer.
Will do. You have an excellent night.
Oh, you too. Thanks a lot.